Welcome to MedVet, a podcast about medicine, vet science, and everything in between. I'm Simeon, a resident at Ipswich Hospital.
And I'm Esther, a final year vet student.
Each episode explores a topic of interest that is important and relevant to both our disciplines.
We hope you enjoy listening and also learn something along the way.
So this is episode 2 of our podcast series.
Part 2 of Diabetes Mellitus.
That's the one. Part 2 of Diabetes Mellitus.
Did I say mellitus?
Okay. Anyways, in this episode, we're going to go through the management and complications of diabetes, primarily type 2 diabetes. So let's dive straight into management. So on the human side of things, there's sort of 5 key principles with management of type 2 diabetes. So number 1 is individualized glycemic goal and therapeutic plan. Number 2 is self-monitoring of blood glucose and HbA1c monitoring. Number 3 is a lifestyle modification. Number 4, detection, prevention, and management of diabetes-related complications. And number 5 is management of diabetes-relevant conditions. How about in animals?
I think for animals, it's just very much, I think, a draw of all of those things that you mentioned, but we like to summarize it into controlling the diabetes while avoiding hypoglycemia.
Yeah.
The easiest way to talk about management.
Yeah. And I guess in a way you could say the same thing about humans, but I guess it's a bit more complex. Here's a few notes on the things that we just mentioned. So self-monitoring of blood glucose. So we advise patients initially to measure their blood glucose several times a day, so including two hours after meals, as well as before bed. And then as they get better control of their sugars, we can reduce the frequency of monitoring all the way down to 2 times a day.
We have that too with animals. We're monitoring every few hours when they start their diabetic treatment.
Yeah. In terms of our HbA1c target, so we talked about HbA1c in our previous episode, in terms of the target, we usually target 7% or less. You can target a higher HbA1c if they're very young or old, if they've got limited lifespan or they have comorbidities. Targeting anything less than that doesn't actually have much evidence base. So a target of 6% or less has been shown to have no benefit and actually may be detrimental in patients with type 2 diabetes and high cardiovascular disease risk. In terms of lifestyle modification, it's really the classic things: weight loss, increased physical activity, healthy diet, right? Easy to say, but really hard to do.
Same with animals.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So make sure you tell your cat to lose weight and run more.
Your cat will hate you, but yeah, it's important.
That's right. Anyways, diabetes relevant conditions we also mentioned. So these include hypertension, dyslipidemia, and obesity. So sort of your classic cardiovascular conditions. So, all right, let's talk about medications. So this in many ways is the mainstay of diabetes management.
The bulk of it.
Yeah, the bulk of it. There's not enough time to go into any real detail with each of these medications, but we'll just give you the broad brush strokes so that you get a good picture in your mind of what medications we can use. It's much simpler, I believe, in animals.
It's simpler in the sense that we don't have oral medications.
Yeah.
We just have insulin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously we use insulin in humans as well. But that's not where we usually start. So the first line treatment for type 2 diabetes is metformin. So metformin has 3 key actions. Number 1, it decreases enteric glucose absorption. Number 2, decreases hepatic gluconeogenesis, and number three, it increases peripheral glucose uptake.
And metformin is an oral medication.
Yeah, it's an oral hypoglycemic, that's right. So it's an example of a biguanide, and how it actually works is it antagonizes the ability of glucagon to generate cyclic AMP in hepatocytes. Cyclic AMP is part of the second messenger pathway in cells. Yep. So metformin decreases HbA1c by about 1% to 2%. Some of its advantages include it doesn't cause hypoglycemia, which some of the other medications can. It's weight neutral. Some of the other medications can cause patients to gain weight, which is obviously an unwanted side effect. And it also improves the lipid profile. However, it also has a number of side effects, including diarrhea, nausea, and more rarely, lactic acidosis and B12 deficiency. It also has a number of contraindications, so you want to check these before you start patients on metformin. So EGFR of less than 30, congestive heart failure, contrast studies, so patients who need, for example, a CT scan with contrast, we cease the metformin on the day of the procedure and for 48 hours afterwards. And it's also contraindicated if someone is in an acidotic state, because it can worsen the acidosis. All right, so that's metformin. Unfortunately, this is a bit of a list coming up of the diabetes medications, but we'll try to work through them in a logical and efficient manner.
And all of these do not apply to the veterinary side of things, so, but worth listening to anyway.
Yeah, so if you're a medical student, I guess open up your ears. If you're a vet student, you can go play with your cat or something. So number one is sulfonylureas. Number two, I can't say this one. I haven't been able to say it since I learned it in med school. It's like thiazolidinediones.
Thiazolidinediones.
Yeah. TZDs, basically. Number three, alpha-glucosidase inhibitors. Number four, DPP-4 inhibitors. And number five... number four, DPP-4 inhibitors and GLP-1 analogs. Those two go together. And number five, SGLT-2 inhibitors. So we'll go through each one of those quickly. Sulfonylureas are an insulin secretagogue. So they stimulate the secretion of insulin. They decrease your HbA1c by about 1% to 2%. Side effects include, however, late postprandial hypoglycemia and weight gain. So, those are the disadvantages of that medication. TZDs, they increase your insulin sensitivity and lipid storage. Decrease your HbA1c by about 0.5 to 1.5%. However, they've got quite a few side effects, which is why we don't use them as often now, including peripheral edema, congestive heart failure, weight gain, fractures, as well as macular edema. Alpha-glucosidase inhibitors. These inhibit oligosaccharide breakdown in the intestinal lumen, so that you have a decreased absorption of sugars. They decrease your HbA1c by 0.5 to 0.8%. They don't cause any hypoglycemia, which is good. However, they make you fart more, right? So side effect is flatulence.
And I assume not many people enjoy that side effect very much.
Yeah. So we don't use it as often because it's not that effective in terms of lowering your HbA1c.
And the farts just really don't help its cause.
Yeah, I guess so. DPP-4 inhibitors and GLP-1 analogs. So DPP-4 inhibitors are an oral medication. However, GLP-1 analogs are injectable, so they're given subcutaneously. They decrease your HbA1c by roughly 0.5 to 1%, and they don't cause hypoglycemia, so they're good in that respect. And then last of all, the newest medication that we have is an SGLT-2 inhibitor. So these increase your renal glucose excretion. So essentially pee out more sugar, decrease your HbA1c by 0.5 to 1%, don't cause any hypoglycemia and actually help you lose weight, which is great. However, they do have their own side effects, including increased urinary tract infections, as well as euglycemic diabetic ketoacidosis. We'll talk about DKA at the end of this episode, but it can cause an euglycemic version of DKA. Just quickly, with the DPP-4 inhibitors and GLP-1 analogs, I didn't really explain how they work. So they increase GLP-1 levels. GLP-1 is an example of something called an incretin, which incretins increase glucose-stimulated insulin secretion. So they help you secrete more insulin, but on the basis of having glucose. It's a glucose-driven process. Mm. DPP-4 inhibitors, they inhibit DPP-4, which breaks down incretins, and GLP-1 analogs are an analog of GLP-1, which is an incretin. Yeah. So that's all of our diabetes medications, apart from insulin, which we'll talk about next.
Insulin is the mainstay therapy for animals. We really have not used the oral hypoglycemics very much, mainly because they're just not very effective, so we choose to go straight to injectable insulins. And they do work very well, and there are a variety of different types of insulin to choose from, and the type really depends on the effectiveness with the individual animal. And there's always a different dose, different type of insulin that may vary between cats. Like, they could all be cats, but they might require very different doses and types of insulin. So that's very important to know, because there is a lot of monitoring, trial and error when it comes to choosing insulin. But generally speaking, you've got a handful of them. You've got two that are registered for veterinary use, and that's caninsulin, also known as vet insulin, which is a porcine derivative. And you also have one called prozinc insulin, or PZI, and that's only for cats. They're the only ones that are actually approved, but vets do still use the human insulins, actually, often at the same amount as they would use caninsulin and PZI, and those would be glargine or Lantus, which is used primarily in cats. It's extremely effective. It lasts for about 12 to 24 hours, which is really ideal for cats because they don't have that postprandial spike in sugar because they don't eat large meals at set times during the day. They tend to graze, and you get that sort of really constant level of sugar, blood sugar levels. So having a long acting insulin is very much ideal, and it works really well for them. Yes, as I mentioned before, PZI works really well too. In terms of dogs, you will use caninsulin quite often, acts for about 8 to 10 hours. That's pretty effective. In dogs, sometimes it's not long enough. So people might opt for, I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's like Toujeo and Detemir, both long-acting options. Becoming more popular for dogs to choose. And you can use glargine, which is often seen with cats, but it's just not as effective. And ultimately, like with insulin, it, as you'd expect with anything, lifestyle change is very important. So you can't just give insulin, you need to alter, say, the type of diet. So more high protein, low carbohydrate diet is ideal. Weight loss, very important. So you're doing like food puzzles and stuff like that, just making it harder for them to eat the food instead of just letting them gorge and that being it.
Food puzzles?
Yeah, they're very effective. Cats, it helps with weight loss, especially with cats.
So it's like a puzzle pieces?
Yeah, or with dogs you get those sorts of maze food things where they got like grooves and stuff. Cats, you could like hide the food and little balls and whatnot, and they have to actually work it to get it. It's good energy burner. I feel like people should do that too, but I don't think it's
going
to... I'm
not sure how ethical that is.
No, but it works with animals. It's effective and we do it. But yeah, that's just generally a very grand sweep of the types of insulin. And quickly, I'd want to mention, you usually start at 0.25 international units per kilo, except for Toujeo and Detemir. I believe Tojay, you want to start with a higher dose of 0.4 international units per kilo. But with Decimir, you want to start at lower doses, which is about a third of the original dose. And that's just due to like the way that they've produced it. It's a different concentration. So that's important to remember, but otherwise it's 0.25 international units per kilo for the other ones. And you will only ever change them by 0.25 international unit increments at a time when you're seeing if it's effective. And generally speaking, insulin is great. It works with dogs and cats. And for cats specifically, you can actually get them to go into remission with insulin dosing on a regular basis for about 6 months. They can actually go into remission. And it's basically their blood glucose curves are looking very good, and then you can really maintain a solid blood glucose curve with that really nice nadir, or like the bottom of the blood glucose curve, the lowest point. It's not too low, not too high, and it's a very good shape of the curve, lasting at the right amount of hours, and you can still maintain that glucose curve even though you're reducing that insulin dose incrementally over time. And then you might reach that point where you have a really, really small dose of insulin, and that's enough to have a beautiful blood glucose curve. And then you can choose just remove the insulin altogether and see if the cat can go into remission, which is basically being able to maintain euglycemia without any additional exogenous insulin. And then that's remission. That works. It's good for cats. You don't see that with dogs, though. Dogs, you'll just have lifelong diabetes that requires control with injectable insulin. So yeah, fun fact about cats.
Yeah, I don't think we see remission in humans.
That's very sad.
I don't think I've heard of that before. Yeah, so we use insulin obviously in humans as well. It's usually used in type 1 diabetes more so than type 2. Like, we definitely use it in type 1. Type 2, you can use it. So there are a few scenarios where you might use it. First of all, add-on therapy. So you can add insulin onto someone's management regime, which already includes oral hypoglycemics. So for example, a long-acting insulin like Lantus, 0.2 to 0.4 units per kilogram in the evening or before bedtime, alongside their metformin and other oral hypoglycemics they might be on. Basal bolus regimen is another scenario. So you can give a long-acting insulin during the nighttime, and then you can give short-acting insulin at meals to help cover for the hyperglycemia that you get from those meals.
That happens with dogs as well.
Yep.
You give them at meal times.
Yep, so that's your basal bolus regimen. And then you can also give insulin as initial therapy, so at the start of someone's management. So there's sort of two main reasons why you do that. Number one is when someone has severe hyperglycemia, so fasting BSL of over 13.9. And number two is when the patient is symptomatic from their hyperglycemia. So we talked about that in the last episode, things like polyuria, polydipsia, fatigue, among other symptoms. Okay. So that's the management side of things. So we'll move on to complications.
Before we go to complications, can I quickly put a little note about monitoring?
Yep.
Extremely important, at least in the veterinary field, because it's the owners that are going to be involved in this heavily, if they choose to be, but they should ideally be. Controlling diabetes, managing it is a hard, hard thing to do with animals. They can't just take tablets. They need to have the insulin. So that's where monitoring comes in. And it's very, very important. You can have the constant, continuous blood glucose monitoring. Or you can have the spot blood glucose testing, which tends to be more common because it's a bit easier to do than maintaining like a constant curve and monitoring it over a 24-hour period, which some people will opt to do, but most people prefer a spot glucose test. And with a spot glucose test, what you're doing is you're using a blood glucose meter, not any different from a human one, and you just take a very, very small prick of like a prick, and then you get a blood sample. And then you do that every few hours, and then you can create a pretty decent blood glucose curve. And that is the mainstay of working out whether your current dose and your type of insulin is effective for that individual pet. And then if that blood glucose curve is not looking good, then you can opt to choose to change the dosing, or you can opt to change the type of insulin if you feel like it's not working well. But ultimately, the very, very important thing about blood glucose monitoring is you need to look at the patient first. You can't just be constantly focusing on that blood glucose curve and trying to make it as perfect as possible when in actual fact the patient's actually doing really well on this dose and there's no actual need to change it if they have no clinical signs that suggest that they are not on the correct dose. And on the flip side, you could have a beautiful blood glucose curve and the patient's just not doing well. And that's when you need to go explore further. What can you do to change it? Because you can't just focus on the numbers. The patient ultimately will come first. And all in all, you need to make sure the owner is committed to actually be giving the insulin at the right time and be able to get the doses at the correct one every time in order to give your pet the best chance, really, to be able to maintain and manage that diabetes well.
Mm. Yeah. Yep. So always treat the patient, not the blood test.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. There's a lot more we could say about management, but we're going to move on to complications now. With complications, you can divide them into six key complications with type 2 diabetes, or well, both type 1 and type 2 diabetes. So the easy way to remember it is the three key microvascular complications and then three key macrovascular complications. So the microvascular complications are retinopathy, nephropathy, and neuropathy. And then the macrovascular complications are ischemic heart disease, cerebrovascular disease, and peripheral vascular disease. There are also a number of non-vascular complications, but we won't touch on those today. We'll just focus on these key six, along with two other key complications, which are hypoglycemia, which is probably the most important complication, and the other one is that we mentioned before, DKA, so diabetic ketoacidosis.
And bearing in mind that these complications are applicable to dogs and cats as well, just some are more prevalent. So you see DKA and diabetic neuropathy more in cats. You'll see cataracts in dogs, which I'll mention a bit later. But you'll also see hypoglycemia in both dogs and cats.
Yep. So these complications are driven by chronic hyperglycemia. And interestingly, in humans, they usually don't appear until the second decade of hyperglycemia.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so they take a little while to develop. So the underlying pathophysiology, there's a couple different theories. One of them is that hyperglycemia leads to epigenetic changes. Another theory is that they lead to increased levels of reactive oxygen species or superoxide, which leads to oxidative stress. So it's not all bad news, though. Improving a patient's glycemic control is of great benefit. And it doesn't matter what HbA1c level this patient may be at, whether it be 7 or 13, improving their control of their sugars will be good for them in the long term in terms of these complications. Alongside that is strict blood pressure control as well, which significantly decreases micro and macrovascular complications. So we'll go through each one of these complications briefly. So the first one is retinopathy. So you can divide retinopathy into non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy and proliferative diabetic retinopathy. So the best thing to do here would be to find images of what we're describing. But with non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy, it's characterized by microaneurysms, blot hemorrhages, as well as cotton wool spots. Cotton wool spots are little patches of ischemia on the retina. And then proliferative diabetic retinopathy is a progression of that disease process. So you get retinal hypoxemia, so not enough oxygen to the retina, which leads to the production of new blood vessels to try to compensate. That's known as neovascularization. And the issue with that is that these new blood vessels are not very effective at what they do. They're quite friable and not as healthy as your normal vasculature. So some of the risk factors for diabetic retinopathy include long-term diabetes and poor glycemic control, which makes sense. And in terms of managing retinopathy, the number one thing is preventing its development. So again, as we mentioned earlier, good glycemic and blood pressure control. Number two is screening for the complication. So patients with type 2 diabetes should be seeing an ophthalmologist every 2 years to check for early signs of diabetic retinopathy. And for patients who have already developed proliferative diabetic retinopathy or macular edema, this is really in the ophthalmologist's field, but options include laser photocoagulation. You can also use anti-VEGF, which is vascular endothelial growth factor. So you're using an antibody against that growth factor, which is involved in the development of new blood vessels. So that's retinopathy.
And since we're on the subject of eyes, I'll briefly mention cataracts, which only dogs get. Cats don't get cataracts, interestingly. Even though they do involve the same mechanism, for some reason, dogs are more affected by it. And we have something known as a sorbitol pathway, which is the conversion of glucose into sorbitol. And when you have excessive glucose, there will be an increase in the production of sorbitol, and that sorbitol pathway does involve the eyes as well. It goes through into the lens, and this is why you get cataracts. It's because you get all of these sorbitol particles suddenly being produced at a much more increased rate than normal in a diabetic patient. And what sorbitol does, it will draw in water into the lens, and that will cause damage and the production of cataracts, which is fairly common in really uncontrolled diabetic dogs. You will get cataract development. And unfortunately, it is irreversible. Surgery for cataracts is not really common. It's basically very uncommon. I don't think I've really heard of it much in dogs. So you really want to get in control of diabetes early on so you don't end up with cataract formation.
Yep. Yeah, same thing with humans. Patients with diabetes are at increased risk of cataracts. I guess unlike dogs, cataract procedures are very commonplace in humans. Okay, so that's the eyes side of things. Nephropathy, so looking at the kidneys now. So diabetic nephropathy is really important because it's the most common cause of end-stage renal disease in many countries. And the progression of the disease sort of has five steps. So you begin with glomerular hyperfiltration. Number two is microalbuminuria. Number three, dipstick proteinuria. Number four, proteinuria in the nephrotic range. And then number five, end-stage renal disease. So risk factors for diabetic nephropathy include race. So for example, African Americans, as well as a family history of diabetic nephropathy. That progression from proteinuria, so protein in the urine, to end-stage renal disease takes about 5 to 10 years. And in terms of management, it's really all about early detection of albuminuria. So albumin, which is a protein in the urine. So it should start annually at the time of the diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. So in terms of screening for albuminuria, you can do random urinary albumin to creatinine ratio. You can also check their eGFR, so their renal function. Estimated glomerular filtration rate. And in terms of the actual treatment side of things, glycemic and blood pressure control can sound a bit like an old record, but again, those two things are really important. Aiming for blood pressure of less than 140 on 90, ACE inhibitors or angiotensin receptor blockers, so they your antihypertensives, which help lower the blood pressure. And you can also restrict the protein intake of patients as well to about 10% of their kilojoule intake, knowing that they're losing protein through the urine. So that's nephropathy. Then we've got neuropathy, so the third microvascular complication.
So diabetic neuropathy, it's a harder one to really pinpoint exactly what causes it. It tends to be multifactorial, but one major contributor is you're going to get a lot of oxidative damage, which will often start in the peripheral nerves, working their way proximally, which you'll see in both humans and animals, at least especially with cats, where you're going to see the effects of damaged peripheral nerves, which you see in the hands and feet of humans, and you see that plantigrade stance in cats where they look like they're crouching. And that, funnily enough, involves the sorbitol pathway again. But instead now we're going from sorbitol to fructose, and this pathway and the enzymes involved will lead to even more oxidative stress, and that leads to even more damage to the nerves, which is why you get diabetic neuropathy quite often. Of course, it's not as simple as that. There are other things, but generally speaking, that's a major contributor to the development of diabetic neuropathy.
Awesome. So with diabetic neuropathy in humans, you can sort of categorize it into three categories. So number one is diffuse neuropathy. So that includes your distal symmetrical polyneuropathy, which you touched on earlier with that sort of distal loss of nerve function, which then moves proximally. You can also get autonomic neuropathy. Number two is mononeuropathy. And number three is radiculopathy or polyradiculopathy. So with diffuse neuropathy, you've got distal symmetrical polyneuropathy that presents with numbness, tingling, sharpness, burning. As we said, starting in the feet and then moving proximally, you get that classic glove and stocking distribution. Autonomic neuropathy. Importantly, here you get it contributes to hypoglycemic unawareness. So that's a really important complication. How that works is that autonomic neuropathy results in decreased levels of counter-regulatory hormones, which means that you're not able to mount a response to hypoglycemia as well as you could before. That can be quite dangerous.
That's pretty scary.
Yeah. Other manifestations of autonomic neuropathy include orthostatic hypotension, anhidrosis, gastroparesis, and erectile dysfunction. In terms of mononeuropathy, so the most commonly involved nerve in diabetes is actually a single nerve, is actually cranial nerve 3. So you can get a cranial nerve 3 palsy in patients with diabetes. Even more important than that is the contribution of diabetic neuropathy to diabetic foot disease. So one component of that is neuropathy, but there's also the vascular component, so you get the vascular disease with diabetes, as well as increased risk of infection. So you can get ulceration in your feet due to the neuropathy and the vascular disease, which then can become infected, usually with aerobic gram-positive cocci like Staphylococcus.
Mm-hmm.
That in all of that together gives you your diabetic foot disease. So it's really important that patients have an annual foot exam. So you get a podiatrist involved. And for patients with severe uncontrolled pain, you can also start them on neuropathic medications like pregabalin or gabapentin.
Which we do use with animals as well. Gabapentin, yep. Very, very popular choice.
Yeah. So yeah, it's really important to get on top of their pain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So before we move on to hypoglycemia and DKA, just wanted to mention cardiovascular disease, which is obviously really important, and it goes hand in hand with diabetes. So in patients with type 2 diabetes, you get a marked increase in myocardial infarction, coronary artery disease, congestive heart failure, peripheral vascular disease, and cerebrovascular disease. So all the bad things. And this is driven by hyperglycemia, as we mentioned mm-hmm. before, as well as other cardiovascular risk factors, including dyslipidemia and hypertension. They all sort of go together.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important to investigate patients who show any symptoms of cardiac ischemia or peripheral or carotid artery disease. So, for example, sending them for an exercise stress test so that we can identify cardiovascular disease early. It's a bit tricky, though, because patients can present atypically. So you can get something called silent ischemia in patients with diabetes. So in a patient having a myocardial infarction, they may not actually have any chest pain. The pattern of dyslipidemia is also a little bit different. So you get hypertriglyceridemia, decreased levels of high-density lipoprotein, HDL, as well as a more atherogenic form of low-density lipoprotein, so LDL. So in terms of the management, there are three key medications to remember. So number one is ACE inhibitors, so again, getting on top of their blood pressure. Number two is statins, so that's for your dyslipidemia, help decrease your LDL, which decreases cardiovascular events and morbidity. And then number three is aspirin, which has been shown to decrease cardiovascular events in patients with both diabetes and coronary artery disease.
Like cardiovascular disease, it is something that we have concerns with in dogs and cats as well. I think often it happens a lot later in life, when they're very much a lot older, because they can get diabetes when they're middle-aged, and cardiovascular disease in animals, at least, it happens very late, and often it's usually more of an end-stage disease more than anything. And I could talk about the different ways of management of heart disease, but it tends to be on its own in terms of treatment. It just happens that diabetes is a contributor to the increased likelihood of getting heart disease. But yeah, in the future, I definitely want to go into a bit more about cardiovascular disease, but for time's sake, we'll just move on.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. So landing the plane now. Hypoglycemia. So three key things to remember with hypoglycemia in terms of the pathophysiology. So number one is activation of the sympathetic nervous system and the appetite center. Number two is brain dysfunction. And number three is generalized glycopenia to metabolizing tissues. So those three things are linked to how hypoglycemia presents in patients as well. So in terms of activating your sympathetic nervous system, so you're going to get sweating, tachycardia, tremor, anxiety, as well as hunger. In terms of your brain dysfunction, you're not getting enough glucose to your brain, so confusion, decreased concentration, altered level of consciousness. You can even get focal impairments like a hemiplegia, seizures, coma. And then in terms of your glycopenia, so not getting enough glucose to metabolizing tissues like your muscles, presents with weakness and fatigue.
Mm.
Yeah.
And hyperglycemia, like we've mentioned before, it's a very, very serious complication. It's something that you...
Just activated Siri.
It's a very important complication. Hypoglycemia is something that in the both medical, human medical and veterinary field, it's so important. And in terms of the vet side of things, as a veterinarian, you need to make sure you tell your owner with their newly diagnosed diabetic pet just started on insulin, you need to tell them what to look out for when it comes to hypoglycemia, because it is life-threatening. It is extremely life-threatening to have a hypoglycemic episode. So you need to tell them to monitor their pet for, say, seizures, extreme lethargy. They're really, really hungry. They're getting all these little focal muscle twitches everywhere. They're really flat and they're just suddenly not themselves anymore. Because giving insulin, if you don't give them the right dose, you don't give them at the right time, especially in dogs, if you just give them insulin and don't give them any food, like these things all contribute to a potential like hypoglycemic event. And because it is so life-threatening, you really need to make sure that the owners know what it is, act accordingly, give them a little bit of honey on the gums or something like that, and get the animal to a vet clinic as soon as possible.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, similar case with humans as well. So really the treatment is just give them sugar, right? Whether that be orally or you can give it intravenously as well. The average, I guess a bit of a clinical pearl, if you like, the average BSL threshold for the onset of hypoglycemic symptoms is less than 3 millimoles per liter. The reason why patients with diabetes get these hypoglycemic events, there's a number of reasons. includes issues with carbohydrate intake, so not taking enough carbs. Physical activities, obviously when you exercise, there's increased demand for glucose. Number three is drug administration, so giving the drugs, taking the drugs at the wrong times, for example. Issues with insulin injection, so if you're not injecting your insulin properly, there can be issues with insulin absorption, which can lead to, you know, if you have erratic absorption of insulin, that's going to give you unpredictable BSL levels, and renal function as well. So insulin is metabolized in the kidneys. So if you've got decreased renal function, that's going to alter your insulin metabolism, which again will lead to unpredictable levels of insulin in the body. All right, last part of the episode is DKA. So DKA is a big topic in itself. So we're gonna try to just touch on the key points. But really, I guess the key thing to remember here is you've got a combination of insulin deficiency and excess of glucagon. And what this leads to is increased lipolysis. So the glucagon drives lipolysis, which leads to increased levels of free fatty acids, which then leads to increased levels of ketone bodies.
Yeah. And you get that increased lipolysis mainly because with insulin deficiency, you're not storing the glucose, and therefore the body is starved of it. And they're turning to their alternative source of energy, which is fat. And that's why you get that increased lipolysis.
Yeah. So to get a bit more nitty-gritty, with the hyperglucagonemia, right? So high levels of glucagon, it's a bit hard to say. It activates an enzyme within the liver known as carnitine palmitoyl transferase 1, which leads to the favoring, if you like, of ketone body production over VLDL production. So usually your free fatty acids would be processed to produce very low density lipoprotein, but because this particular enzyme is activated, it favors ketone body production instead. When you have increased ketone bodies, they exist as ketoacids at physiological pH, which leads to the depletion of bicarbonate, which gives you the metabolic acidosis in DKA. So it's sort of the pathophysiology of the condition. So in terms of your biochemistry, obviously you're going to have a low pH. So in humans, it's less than 7.35, usually.
Less than 7.3-ish.
Yeah, so animals, sort of the same ballpark. You're looking at a bicarbonate of less than 15. Increased anion gap, so it's a high anion gap metabolic acidosis. Obviously, your ketones will be high, so greater than 1. The BSL can actually be normal, but often it's increased.
Yeah, often increased.
And you also get hypokalemia as well. So you get an electrolyte disturbance.
Yeah. And you're also, if you look in the liver enzymes, you're going to see elevated liver enzymes because they're going through so much more disturbance with increased lipolysis, which obviously involves the liver. And also elevated triglycerides with the mobilization of all those fats, you're going to get an increase in that as well. And ultimately with DKA, the only way you can properly treat it, at least in animals, you need to give insulin.
Yeah.
Like there's no way you can just leave them to kind of sort themselves out. Insulin is absolutely necessary.
Yeah. Insulin. Queensland Health has a great DKA protocol. So it's quite straightforward in terms of how you manage it. You can just follow the steps. So we're quite good at managing DKA these days. So in terms of the reasons why people go into DKA, you can sort of narrow it down to the three I's, if you like. So number one is inadequate insulin administration, so not taking enough insulin. Number two is infection, so things like pneumonia, urinary tract infections, gastroenteritis, sepsis. And number three is infarction, so whether that be cerebral, coronary, mesenteric, or peripheral.
And very similar for animals. Probably the first one the most. inadequate insulin administration often is an issue, but it could also be the doses are wrong with the choice of insulin, things like that. But it is very much important to make sure that the owner is giving the insulin correctly. And in cats as well, you can see DKA in the early onset when they haven't been diagnosed yet, and you start to see the signs of DKA. And that's quite fairly common with cats. You do see it. So it's very important to be able to work out that they do have DKA and it's an emergency. In that sense, you really need to give them insulin immediately in that case. Yeah.
Yep. All right. So how does DKA actually present? So you can get nausea and vomiting, thirst or polyuria, abdominal pain, shortness of breath. In terms of clinical signs, they can be tachycardic, appear dehydrated, tachypnea or Kussmaul's respiration. So Kussmaul's respiration is this sort of labored breathing pattern, which is the body's response to the metabolic acidosis. So what you're trying to do is you're actually trying to blow off CO2 as a compensatory mechanism to the metabolic acidosis. I can also get abdominal tenderness and lethargy.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's it.
Yeah.
So that's the management and complications of type 2 diabetes.
Crash course. It's definitely not everything that you need to know.
Yeah.
But we tried to cover the big points.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know that was a lot to take in, but hopefully that was helpful. Thanks for tuning in. Please remember to drop a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I don't even know if you can.
I don't know.
Yeah, definitely Apple Podcasts. I probably should look into that. Tune in next time. We'll move on from diabetes and do something else in our next episode. So we'll catch you then.
Bye.